Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for anchor Rick Moore. Rick returns next Sunday. This week, we look back at three stories we ran in 2017 that are even more relevant today. Later in the program, you'll hear from Brian Cannon, Executive Director of One Virginia 2021, and filmmaker Bill Oglesby about gerrymandering, the practice of drawing district lines to favor the election of specific politicians. Also later in the program, controversial Charlottesville City Council independent candidate Nikita Walker talks about the alt-right rally which took place in Charlottesville on August 12, 2017, and the role of government in protecting its citizens. But first, 2017 was a difficult year for Charlottesville with the alt-right rally in August that left a woman and two police officers dead. In January, Kareem Jania spoke with host Rick Moore about racism in Charlottesville from the perspective of a Muslim man. Our story is entitled Being Muslim in Charlottesville. Here's Sunday morning wake-up call anchor Rick Moore.
I'd like to know some basic truths and falsehoods about what it is about being Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me start off firstly with putting this into context. So I actually am doing my PhD at the Darden Business School. And my wife is a physician. She is doing her fellowship in pediatric endocrinology at the UVA Health Center. And we don't have any kids. But I start this off with giving you the context of who we are as a family, because when people sometimes think about Muslims, they think of an abstract and they don't really come to think of who these individuals are or what their aspirations and how do they lead their day-to-day lives. They tend to think of what do we see on TV as individuals, as Muslims, what do they represent, it's them versus us. What they don't know is Muslims are actually here and have been here on this continent ever since slaves were brought from Africa. Believe it or not, up to 30% of the black slaves that were brought from Africa were Muslim slaves that came to the plantations, and they were not allowed to practice their religion. So Muslims are not new to this land. Muslims have been active, whether it is on the social, civil liberties, or other rights. If we talk about Malcolm X, for example, and his contributions to American civil liberties, if you talk about Muhammad Ali, someone who just passed away last year, and his contributions, whether it is to civil liberties or just to philanthropy or just sports. We talk about pop culture and sports. You know, you've got Hakeem Olajuwon. You've got other Muslim figures. So the Muslim community, first of all, to start with, is not a new community to this land. People may think it is. The media may portray it as it is, but it's not foreign to this land. It is not something that is just in recent years has been brought in terms of a population. So speaking of the Muslim community post 9/11, things were different. And more recently, post the election season, again, things took a different turn of events. So if we're to talk about, you know, the harassment that Muslims face on a day-to-day basis, whether that is, you know, imams being killed in New York, mosques being burnt down in Texas, in Washington State, women being having their headscarves being pulled off, many, many, many different incidents that really do not represent what this country was built upon. What do Muslims believe in? Well, other than the fact that we believe in one God and prophets that were sent to humanity and angels and books, you cannot be a Muslim if you do not believe in Jesus Christ as one of the prophets. This is a fundamental belief. And you cannot be a Muslim if you do not believe in Moses as being sent as one of the prophets. We believe that it's a brotherhood that extends back all the way to Prophet Adam. And so these are the basic beliefs of Muslims, and what we kind of do on a day-to-day basis is basically revive these beliefs through prayer and other things.
Were you worried then when you, family members, friends, were you concerned when some of the rhetoric was about we'll have a temporary ban on all Muslims from entering the country, which, and I didn't research in a dreary manner, so I can't remember that he said we will have a checklist, but I believe that others said that that will lead to him presenting the need for a checklist. But were those sorts of things on your screen, or like many, did you say, that'll never happen because he's not a real candidate?
I think that's a very important point that you ended off with. I think for much of the Muslim community, and actually for much of society, no one really thought that Donald Trump would actually win and become a president of the United States. Many underestimated that and were shocked when the results came out of the election. So were there worries? Definitely there were worries. But in the minds of many, these worries were lingering around, thinking that, yes, they're there, but most probably he won't win, so we shouldn't stress out about them. But now that he's won, I think there's a lot more anxiety. There's a lot more fear. There's a lot more uncertainty that surrounds the Muslim community, in anticipation of what's going to happen. And I think in this past couple of days, we've seen some of the executive orders that have been given, whether it is banning Muslims from seven nations, and that's approximately 134 million people from entering the United States based on what they believe in, which is something so contradictory to what this country actually is founded on. We don't reject people on the basis of what they believe in. You know, the poem that is engraved on the Statue of Liberty, one line in it says, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." This is the spirit of America. We celebrate diversity. Diversity is our strength. It is not our weakness. It is not what divides us. And if you don't recognize that you were an immigrant at some time, except if you were a Native American, then you have a problem. Because the difference between you and I is that you just came in an earlier boat. That's all. Everyone else immigrated to this land, except if you're a native, all right? It's just a matter of when you immigrated. Now, I go back to that point about diversity being the strength. America was built on the backs of immigrants. Where America has reached right now, it's based on the strengths that immigrants have came to this land and contributed to its development. Whether it is scientists, whether it's laborers, whether it is any other role or position that they have in society. So I think that is something that is crucial to everyone when they're listening and thinking about this. And not to frame it in such a way as, wait a second, we're here, we are the people of this country, and we don't want anyone else to actually come in.
You're listening to a replay of our 2017 interview with Karim Janina on being Muslim in Charlottesville. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Once again, here's Rick Moore.
Your thought as a member of the Muslim community when you saw that this was actually going to happen and the way it was going to start taking place?
I think it was much like my thought when he signed that executive order saying he's going to build the wall. And much like my thoughts when he basically told the Mexican population that we're going to impose taxes, a 20% tax on your goods. It is much of the same frustration. This country is not built upon the foundational premise of building walls and boundaries. Ever since the beginning, this country is based upon pluralism, it's based upon diversity, it's based upon freedom of religion, it is based upon rights, it is based upon all these different ideals that Americans cherish. So saying to people that we're going to ban you on the basis of what you believe in terms of your religious convictions is betraying the fundamental beliefs of this country and the values of this country. And by the way, it does not make America safer. It definitely does not make America safer.
Why do you say that?
I say that because...
because somebody's going to say...
yes?
What inside information do you have?
Well...
I mean, that's what a xenophobic person is going to say,
right?
Oh, you have a Muslim on the radio saying that. Where's his inside information?
Right. If you are to look at, you know, the 780,000 refugees that have come to America ever since 9/11, there are zero terrorist attacks that have occurred as a result of these refugees. If the premise is we're going to protect America because we're going to be banning Muslims and refugees, who some of them are Muslims, others are Christians, and others are of different other faiths, then you're wrong. Because the statistics actually prove something else. The statistics say that those who commit terrorist attacks have been radicalized, not at the mosques, but in front of their computers. And the FBI knows that very well. Why? Because they go to their computers, they sit there, and they start reading things that have been posted by these terrorist organizations, and they start putting these things into action. In fact, the statistics show that people who go to mosques do not commit these types of events because that is not what is preached in the mosques. In fact, the opposite is preached. And like I said earlier in the program, there is a very high correlation between people identifying themselves as Muslims and being active in society as local and abiding citizens of this country and contributing to this country. So going back to the ban and the executive orders that have been issued, I think they have created an uproar. And we see the protests at, you know, whether it is the Women's March and what it stood for, whether it is at the current airports, as we speak right now, there are mayors that are protesting, whether it is in Boston or other places, because that's not who we are.
People ask, why don't the Muslims shout down the radical Muslims more? Do you feel as though the radical Muslims have taken over the vocalization of your religion, or that the Americans are just too ignorant to understand the difference? I realize that's a loaded question.
I feel like the media puts the spotlight on what is sensational. You know, you don't wake up in the morning listening to the news saying everything's going to be okay today and everything's running fine. When you switch on that channel, you want to be listening to, oh, what happened yesterday? What protests are on? What went off? What? And that's what the media basically does, is they shine the spotlight on what is sensational. So when they see a group, a minute, and let me repeat that and emphasize that, a minute number of individuals who claim that they are Muslims and who go about blowing up things, that's who they focus and they bring to the spotlight, because it's sensational. They don't come to the, you know, your local mosque highlighting all the good that you do. They focus on what is sensational. And so what becomes frustrating is when you've got masses of people tuning in to these news channels, these radio broadcasts and whatnot, that are focusing completely on this group of individuals who have hijacked the religion in terms of everything that the religion doesn't stand for. They take away as their own interpretation of the religion and use it as a basis for them to actually gain power. And then they start to say that they speak on behalf of Muslims. Well, who are they to speak on behalf of 1.5 billion Muslims? I am active with an organization here in Charlottesville, and I even am wary of saying that I speak on behalf of that organization, because you have to just represent yourself. And if you're to look at the sheer majority of Muslims, they have condemned the actions of terrorist organizations who are criminals, who are clearly criminals by the Islamic Penal Code, are considered criminals. But no matter how much you tell the public that you denounce their actions, they're still waiting for you to be apologetic on a continuous basis. And I feel that that is unfair. You do not have to be apologetic about the actions of anyone else other than yourself. You do not have to be apologetic about actions of the Ku Klux Klan just because you may be Christian or something else. It is those people that need to come out to the forefront and say what we're doing is wrong. Irrespective of that, Muslims have day in and day out went out and broadcasted clearly statements saying, we denounce these actions. They are forthright. These actions are not part of our religion. These actions are not what we believe in. But yet, that's what the spotlight gets shined on. And that's what people listen to and tune to. And that's why it's our duty as Muslims is to actually engage more with the community and to build that human connection. And that's why I thank you for having me today, to be able to speak out my beliefs and what my teachings and what I believe my religion has taught me as a human being living in a pluralistic society, not believing in what others are doing on the other side of the world, or even if they're radicalized in America.
You've been listening to a replay of Rick Moore's January 2017 interview with Karim Janina on Being Muslim in Charlottesville. After the break, Brian Cannon, Executive Director of One Virginia 2021, and filmmaker Bill Oglesby talk about gerrymandering in Virginia and around the country. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. Gerrymandering is the practice of drawing district lines to favor the election of specific politicians. Democrat Governor-elect Ralph Northam has publicly announced that he will veto any redistricting plan from the Virginia legislature that does not fairly represent its people. In June, I talked with Brian Cannon, Executive Director of One Virginia 2021, and filmmaker Bill Oglesby about their organization's efforts to end gerrymandering in Virginia. All right, let's dig into the nitty-gritty. Brian, how did gerrymandering get started? What's the history of it?
Well, the original sin in this was the U.S. Constitution leaves the power to draw congressional districts to the states. And the Madison's idea of having communities get together and elect their representatives makes perfect sense, except for when you let the politicians who are in power draw the line. So actually the first problem with gerrymandering started out here in the 5th Congressional District for the first race where Madison and Monroe were put together in the same congressional district in an attempt to affect the outcome. But the kind of modern history on this would be with the equal population requirement in districts that came about from Baker v. Carr in the 1960s, a Supreme Court case that gave us one man, one vote, which is another really good idea, but it's just led to some shenanigans being played.
And I've heard people say that gerrymandering is the issue in politics today. Is that true?
I would say, yeah, there's a lot of really important issues that we should all be focusing on. But as it's been told to me a couple of times before, gerrymandering is not the issue I care about the most, but it's the issue I have to care about first. And I think that, you know, when you look at this, this is much similar to 20 years ago when McCain was pushing campaign finance reform. This is the ethical issue in our politics. This is the shorthand for how do you know your politician, whether they're right or left or center, is ethical, whether they're willing to fight this kind of corrupt and rigging the system practice.
Now, just to be very clear, that the goal of One Virginia 2021 is not to get more Democrats elected, right?
that is true. So we go on on progressive stations and circles like WPVC, and we get folks to say, "Is One Virginia 2021 just a sneaky Republican organization?" And then I'll go to my Republican friends or organizations. I'll say, "One Virginia 2021, you're just a sneaky Democratic organization." And we're not either. We're bipartisan and multipartisan, in fact, with Greens and Libertarian support as well. And we really just, the thing that unites us on this issue is that we believe these districts should belong to Virginians, not to any party or politician.
And it's true that both political parties practice gerrymandering.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Democrats did it for forever. Republicans in Virginia got the reins to do it in 2001. And then actually Democrats and Republicans teamed up and did it to Virginians together back in 2011, which is the current gerrymander we live under today.
And across the country, is gerrymandering more prevalent in some states rather than in others?
A few states have figured out how to fix this. So some states have passed citizen resolutions to fix it. Others have gone through their general assemblies to fix it. But I would say that Virginia is probably in the top five of the bad ones. A lot of the mid-Atlantic states where you have a diverse population, where you have rivers and a Chesapeake Bay carving you up, which gives you extra opportunity for that. But yeah, that's the we're unfortunately in the bad category on this around the country. But it is an American problem.
Right. Now, you've explained earlier that the process is basically to get the right kind of voters in the right kind of district so that you can either get an advantage or give your opponent a disadvantage. So the big question that everybody asks about this is, how do they know how I'm going to vote? Bill?
It's something where, they have, there are all sorts of give me a little bit of more idea what you're talking about. I want to make sure I hit exactly what you were wanting to.
Well, they have these computer programs, I understand, that they can use to draw these lines. And they can say, I want to put Bill Oglesby in a certain district because he tends to vote one way or the other. How do they know how Bill Oglesby is going to vote?
That's exactly correct. And that's the thing. The algorithms are such that you can now know, you know, they know more about you online than you know about yourself, is what I often say. The fact of the matter is they can know so much that they can literally draw lines very specifically down streets. You know, one of the requirements of districting is that districts be contiguous, meaning there can't be breaks in the district. It has to be one continuous line. And yet, if you look at them on a map, there are many of these gerrymandered districts that look like they're not contiguous. They are, but it's only because in some cases there's a line that just goes down a street, literally. They can draw it around individual houses. They can draw it around city blocks. They can do all sorts of things because they know that in all likelihood, the people who are living in these houses probably tend to favor one party over another.
Let me be sure, Dan, that we assure your listeners, we do still have a secret ballot that is intact. It's something we borrowed from the Australians in about 100 or so years ago. It's not original in America. It used to be apparently a very public declaration of who you were voting for. But we do still have a secret ballot. However, we know which elections people voted in. And when you go to a primary, like I hope folks did the other Tuesday here in Virginia, when you go to a primary, you select either a Democrat or Republican ballot, which personally bothers me. I wish I could take them both, but you can't. And so that choice is also recorded. So if I look into Bill's voting history, which is available to the parties and to certain advocacy organizations, if I look into Bill's voting history and I see that Bill voted consistently in Democratic primaries since he was, you know, 18 years old, and you can kind of much see that, and then I know I don't have to know who Bill pulled the lever for in the general election. I'm going to guess he pulled it for the Democrat, right?
Right.
And on top of that, you add in all the data he talks about. You know, they can find out whether, you know, they can pull your Capital One credit card and find out whether you buy Crest or Colgate toothpaste and put it into some big model and find out that means you're, you know, a Bernie Sanders type Democrat versus a Hillary Democrat or whatever it is. You know, they're able to really get that detail.
What magazines do you subscribe to?
Yeah, memberships you have.
All sorts of things that, and these algorithms are worked out so that they can know there's at least a likelihood of you leaning toward a certain Democratic Party by the actions you take.
And it sounds from looking at the results that it works pretty well. I mean, it sounds like they can find out how you're going to vote pretty accurately because gerrymandering is very successful, right?
Yeah. So the iteration that the two big things that have happened in the last 2 years or 2 decades on this has been first the kind of Karl Rove data mining revolution where they started taking consumer data, all of which Bill just mentioned, and kind of plugging that into voting histories and making predictive models. The next part is, for gerrymandering's purposes, is, you know, the number one enemy to gerrymandering is that people move, right? So you draw the districts once a decade, but then over the course of that decade, people leave Southwest Virginia and they move into Northern Virginia. Well, what if you could predict the rate at which they're going to move into Northern Virginia? There's going to be an increased Latino population around Lorton, Virginia here. Charlottesville is going to grow in this way. There's going to be a new development over here. If they start incorporating that, which they have, then these maps that they draw once a decade at the beginning of the decade remain sticky for the whole decade.
You're listening to my June 2017 interview with Brian Cannon, executive director of One Virginia 2021, and filmmaker Bill Oglesby about their organization's efforts to end gerrymandering in Virginia. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And what are some of the more egregious examples of gerrymandering? I'm thinking of, in particular, of the Red Map Project. Bill?
Yeah, the Red Map Project was it really was born out of the big win that Barack Obama had in 2008. And, of course, the Democrats at that time controlled both houses of Congress as well. And I interviewed one of the architects of Red Map, whose name was Chris Jankowski, and he talked about how he was so depressed at the results of that election and was trying to think of something that could be done to reverse that. And he came up with the fact that, hey, we're coming up on the census of 2010. that will be followed very quickly by the redrawing of districts all across the country. And so what can we do to reverse this situation we're finding ourselves in now? And so what they targeted was they targeted key districts across the country, and for a relatively small amount of money. Now, we're talking millions of dollars, but nationwide, it was a relatively small amount of money. They poured money into certain local races so that they could actually take over the control of state houses across the country that would then be responsible for drawing the districts in those states, redrawing the districts. And as a result, we have seen, of course, that we have Republican control in a great majority of the districts across the country now, and they then have had the power to, in most cases, those legislatures have had the power to redraw the maps in their favor in those states.
So why is it different what happened in 2010 as compared to all the years before that? Gerrymandering's been around since the 1960s. What made the Red Map project so successful?
Well, I think what happened really was that they were smart about it. They literally studied where can we most effectively put our resources, where can we literally pour money. I mean, there were some districts where you had the same representative, the same Democratic representative in that case, for many years, and who appeared to be relatively popular, but they poured money into the opponent's race and were able to make a difference. And these kinds of algorithmic changes that we've talked about in the ability to know where the voters are has really been of great advantage then when they took over the legislature to be able to redraw those districts in a way that clearly benefited one party over another.
In a minute, we're going to talk about the feature-length film that you and Bill made on the subject. But before we do that, I would just like to talk about the kind of the main areas of advocacy that you've established. Let's talk about them one at a time. Independent Redistricting Commission, what does that mean?
Sure. You know, if you think about this, you know, if we're having a baseball game between Republicans and Democrats, you got to have some umpires there, right? Somebody's got to call balls and strikes and safe and out. Because nobody would trust the batter to call his own balls and strikes, because it's a conflict of interest. So the Independent Redistricting Commission is something that about a dozen other states have. Some have better structures than others. We can learn from that. But the bottom line is we got to get the right now in Virginia, the most self-interested people on the planet draw the lines. We got to find a better way to do it. We can't let the same politician who runs in that district then draw the district for himself for the next decade.
So what would you say to critics who say that an independent commission is just the same as we have now, but without the transparency?
Yeah, well, what's funny is we have no transparency now because the General Assembly has what's called legislative privilege. So, and actually the Senate Democrats asserted this when we filed a lawsuit over the gerrymandered districts. They wouldn't let us get to what they were thinking or doing or their working papers for it. So if you gave this to an independent commission that did not have legislators on it, which I think is an important part, if you gave it to an independent commission, that commission becomes FOIA-able. Under the Freedom of Information Act, you can actually get their documents, which would be a great step forward to having a little transparency and sunshine in that process.
In the states that have successfully done this, that have had independent commissions to do their to draw the lines, has the process traditionally been transparent in those states?
Some more than others. You know, I don't want to make the setup the argument that the perfect is the enemy of the good here. Anything's better than what we've got. But a lot of times you see a lot more commission hearings. You see a process where the legislators don't control it and don't protect the documents, don't protect their working products, and they're out there in the open. It's not perfect, but I don't think we have to be perfect to be better.
Talk about public participation in the process as you see it.
Yeah, so right now, even Virginia does have a public participation element. The problem is it doesn't matter, right? Because the people, they'll go on a road show all around the states. The legislators will do their shows, and they'll listen to people, but they won't hear them. And it doesn't matter. They'll go ahead and draw the districts how they want. Public participation has to be a really active part that we all take ownership of, and we have to do it before they draw the lines. Right. We can't wait to say, oh, here's the map. Oh, I don't like the maps. No, we have to say, look, this community has to grow or shrink. We might not know exactly by how much, but the district itself is going to have to get smaller or bigger geographically to accommodate a growing or shrinking population. Here's where we believe we should go, you know, to reflect our community. The community has to be involved in this early, and we've got to force the politicians to hear us.
I'd like to move on a little bit now to where do we go from here? One Virginia 2021 is active in a lot of different areas. The three main ones are litigation, ballot reform, and legislative reform. I was wondering, Brian, if you'd talk about each of those in turn. Let's start with litigation.
Sure. Well, you know, here's the good news, Dan, is that there's a lot of progress on this issue, broadly speaking. This is coming up in the zeitgeist for people. People are talking about it. If you just do Google Trends, you go into Google Trends and you type in the word gerrymandering, you will see a huge spike in this issue coming in the last couple of years. People are really starting to wake up to this being the ethical issue in our politics. One of the key ways that's happening is through litigation. Folks are hearing about this in the courts. The Supreme Court keeps taking up these cases. A lot of them are racial gerrymandering cases. We just heard last week the Supreme Court's going to hear a case from Wisconsin about partisan gerrymandering. And in Virginia, we've got our own litigation. One Virginia 2021 sponsored litigation that filed suit to defend Virginia's constitutional requirement for compactness. If you look at any of these maps, you wouldn't know that's there. But they are supposed to be compact, and somebody's got to stand up for that. And we're doing that here in Virginia.
And have you brought any litigation forward so far?
Yeah, so that's the litigation. So we sued.
And how did it go?
So we lost in the trial court, and we are appealing to the state Supreme Court. We'll never go any further than that. That's the terminal court for this. But we're really proud of what we did because we sued over 11 districts in Virginia. And these districts were, six of them were drawn by Senate Democrats, five of them were drawn by House Republicans. So it's the first bipartisan or really nonpartisan lawsuit in Virginia that's not about racial or political gerrymandering, but let's just look at the books, laws we have on the books today, and see if we can enforce them. And that's through the compactness requirement in our Constitution.
All right. Ballot reform, not available in Virginia, I understand.
Yes.
How can that be used in other states?
In other states, citizens have taken this upon themselves to say enough's enough. And they've said that, you know, to heck with their general assemblies or their state legislatures, and they've gone around them to institute reform. Most of the states that have done this have gone about this process, though not completely, but that's the way it happened. We don't have that option here in Virginia. We have to go through our legislature.
And that brings us to the third main area of advocacy, legislative reform. Are we making any progress on that?
We are, and people always ask me, you know, Brian, even if you're right and you have the best idea, politicians will never give up their power to do this. And that's a really skeptical way to look at it. But I understand completely. I mean, we shouldn't go into this starry-eyed thinking that just because we have the right idea, we're going to win this. We've got to have the right idea. We've got to have people talking about this, making it. I can't just say it's the ethical issue of the day. Everyone has to say it's the ethical issue of our day and really raise this issue to our politicians. Here's the good news. From a micro look on gerrymandering, there are actually states, New York, Ohio, and Nebraska, whose state legislatures have passed reform. So when people tell me, oh, state politicians would never give up this power, I'm like, well, that's just not true at all. Three of them have done it so in the last couple of years. For what it's worth, Nebraska's governor vetoed the darn thing. But if you look at those three states, they're all pretty different politically, different geographically. You know, Governor Kasich, Republican governor in Ohio, led that fight there. You know, so there's a lot of hope to be had here. In Virginia, we've got about 35 out of 40 state senators that are in favor of reform, and we've got about 60 of 100 House of Delegates members who are in favor of reform. Now, that's not quite enough because some of the House Republican leadership in Virginia has still been opposing this. But I think generally speaking, the momentum is there and the path to victory through Virginia's legislature is there.
You've been listening to my June 2017 interview with Brian Cannon, Executive Director of One Virginia 2021, and filmmaker Bill Oglesby, about their organization's efforts to end gerrymandering in Virginia. After the break, Charlottesville City Councilor-elect Nikia Walker talks about her personal experience during the alt-right rally in Charlottesville on August 12th, as well as her run for City Council. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. Then City of Charlottesville Council candidate Nikia Walker experienced the events of the August 12th alt-right rally in Charlottesville firsthand. In November, Walker easily won her seat on the council. She joined us in September to talk about her experiences on August 12th, as well as her run for councilwoman in November. Once again, here's Sunday morning wake-up call anchor Rick Moore.
So let's just jump into things. I'd like to talk about August 12th to start with, and we'll jump back and forth between that and the election, if you don't mind.
We can do that.
So I had the Legal Aid Justice Center on here on the program a couple weeks ago, and they had, at that point, that they had, it had been recent since they had put out a press release where they had called out the law enforcement response. They had used words and phrases such as indifference to safety, failure to intervene, disappointing. I'm curious your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, so I kind of have two, you know, there are two thoughts. Like, that's the experience of Black and low-income communities all the time, so you're not that shocked. You know, if officers go into those areas, it's usually an abusive way. But August 12th, with the diversity that was on the scene in Charlottesville, it was very surprising that officers would allow, you know, citizens to be abused in the manner that they were abused, that standing back, not protecting, in that kind of environment, not knowing who you could trust, with the level of assaults that were taking place, it was very disappointing, disheartening, scary, and you would have hoped for better, especially after July 8th and the night before August 11th at UVA, that they would have gotten to a different place. And I don't think anyone expected, like, what I mean, that if you were on the scene, things were pretty chaotic. It was very traumatizing. I don't think you can plan for that, but I think you can take heed to the warnings that you get along the way. But more importantly, I think you want leaders in place who can plan quickly on their feet when disasters like that, you know, are occurring. And I think that's what my question is. Why, when it was obvious that, you know, the level of trauma, the level of pain, the potential, because three people lost their lives and Heather lost her life, you know, with the being victimized by the terrorists with the car. But you want to know that your leadership can make adjustments quickly. And that, even in the videos, being abused, the car coming, you know, we had Virginia National Guard, the truck on the scene where there should have been ambulance on 4th Street that day. You want the response to meet the needs, and you want your leaders to be able to meet those needs, and that didn't happen.
Do you believe that there were orders for police to stand down?
Yes, it appeared that way. I mean, how do you get a coordinated effort by a group of people, in this case law enforcement, to do the same thing, participate in the same activity? Someone had to give them orders. They didn't coordinate that amongst themselves. So where did it come from? My concern mainly is from, even, you know, if there's a terrorist attack planned on, the first thing that you have to do is to protect the people who've been put elected to make decisions. You know, they have to be protected. So if they are out there in harm's way, able to be gunned down, I think that should be problematic for all of us. But the fact that we didn't see you didn't show up, we don't know what you were doing with the information you were receiving, that's a more important question for me. Where were you? What were you doing? And were you making decisions? And what were those decisions from where you were? Whether they would have been able to serve us best in the chaotic environment that was out there on the 12th, I can't say. I don't think. Who would have, if one of them or all of them had been in the midst of that kind of chaos and had been run over, by the car, who makes the decisions for the city. So I think about things like that, you know, but I do want to know where they were and what was their thinking processes throughout the day.
Have you or has anyone asked that question as to where they were and what they were doing during this time?
Yeah, I think the entire city, state, country, internationally, a lot
have,
of people.
Have we been, other than that six-hour city council meeting, have answers been given during that time period?
No. So, again, who are you protecting? Because I think for this level, again, of collaboration, someone has to have given an order for you not to be able to speak. No one is telling us any information about the events of that day in terms of our current leadership. So the same order that the police receive, apparently our leadership has received.
So let's talk about what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Nakiah Walker with us here, someone who was... Mm. On the streets on August 12th. Were you out on August 11th on Friday night?
Yeah, I was at the church August 11th.
I won't assume that everybody listening or listening to the podcast after the fact knows the church that you're talking about.
Mm. So there was an event with Cornell West and Tracy Blackmon up UVA on the 11th. It just escaped me which church that was. But, yeah, so we were at that event right before the torch-lit rally.
It went down, went across grounds and ended up at Jefferson statue.
Yes.
Okay.
So I was not there. I was at the church. I was with Jeff Fogle. We left a little bit early and then went back to see if people needed any assistance after we heard about the march.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So then on Saturday the 12th, you were on the streets.
I was.
Tell me about some of the things you saw and about some of the events, for lack of a better word. I'm sure I'll use poorly chosen words multiple times throughout the hour.
Well, I think first... what has been posted on social media, I haven't posted any of it.
That's a good thing to say. You're not bragging about, the major thing that people have may have seen is something that I saw through Dave Norris, someone who was elected to city council 20 years ago now, 15 years ago.
Not 20.
Sorry, Dave.
Somewhere within that, 10 to...
And was also mayor of Charlottesville.
Yes, he was.
But is also supporting you because your Epic has decided to support you.
Endorse, yeah.
But Mr. Norris and representing Epic was on this program back in, February.
Mm-hmm.
So let's put that out there as well.
Okay.
But tell us about the event that has been on Facebook.
So I started, talking about the fact that I haven't put anything out there because it's a challenging, day. I'll just say that. But that event occurred. Dave Norris' account, he was standing right there, is accurate from everything that I've seen. I just saw white men with guns, and I saw people bleeding. I saw a lady on the sidewalk with her head cracked, and then I saw citizens with no weapons standing there, and it was a pretty scary, scary situation. So I talked to the militiamen. I didn't know who they were at the time, just like, why are you here?
This is a parking lot.
This is the parking lot where the market is usually.
South Street, bang, that parking lot, correct?
Mm-hmm. And based on their response to me, there wasn't any aggression. They told me, the guy I spoke to initially told me that they were there, they were trying to help. they were trying to keep peace on both sides. They made it clear that they didn't agree with the white supremacist neo-Nazis, nor did they agree with like Antifa, Black Lives Matter. They thought that they needed to make sure that people were safe from all groups. You know, that was, you know, sort of the conversation. And I asked him what they were trying to do in that moment, and he said they were trying to leave. So I went to the other side of the street and just asked them what were their intentions, what did they want to happen in this moment, and they said they didn't want them in our town. And I told them, they informed me that they were trying to leave so we could make some room. And so that was the conversation. You know, that's what happened.
And you received a lot of praise on social media for preventing another battle, however major or minor it might have been, but some sort of scuffle between two more groups by talking to one and listening to what he, getting him to his point about what he wanted to do and letting them get to their cars and leave.
Yes, and without, you know, being able to predict, you know, very possibly, there was a lot of people who were angry, citizens who were angry, who had been fighting. I don't, you know, I was fearful for them. You have a group of men who have guns. They didn't have any. So that was my, they could kill you. So we need to let them go if that's their, you know, intention. It was just it was a hard day, and you just never know. You never know anything. And August the 12th was horrible. Even in that moment, it was horrible.
You're listening to Rick Moore's September 10th interview with Nakia Walker about the events of August 12th in Charlottesville and her run for city council. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Again, here's Rick Moore.
Let's talk about city council. Your run for city council.
Yes.
59 days until the election.
Yes. Have to exhale every moment because it's real. It's real, real.
exciting.
Huh? Yeah, it's been, you know, so my campaign slogan is Unmasking the Illusion. And before the events of the summer here, people thought that was pretty dramatic. They thought that, you know, I was kind of going overboard and being a little extra. You know, I got those kind of comments. What are you talking about? What a loser.
Where's the drama?
Place. Yes. And so no one is asking me that now because of the events that unfolded here and with Charlottesville being.
Right. Can I break up my tarot cards now?
And so that's it. That it has existed. This kind of almost deceitful behavior. I've seen witness that, you know, for a lot of years. And so that was why my, you know, decision to run as an independent, that came out of, you know, Democrats have been in charge in Charlottesville, and look at the state we're in. So even though a lot of people were able to hide behind the illusion, the pretense, the perfection, as they claim, of Charlottesville, the beauty of it. If you live in this two-tier, beautiful, ugly city, as Reverend Brenda Groom said, then you know differently. You know differently before the events of the summer. And so that I wanted to make sure, if nothing else, between March and November, that we at least had those difficult conversations about why my decision to run as an independent and what did my campaign slogan mean?
Exhausting.
Very. Yes. Most of my life has been exhausting. It's that kind of city we live in.
Explain that a little bit.
I mean, if you are, you either figure out a way to ignore the work and, you know, mask the pain of growing up and living in a city that doesn't honor you, value you, or you fight it, which is exhausting too. So that's what I've seen on the other tier. that was not able to have behind the illusion, figuring out how to mask the pain, which means there's a lot of devastation in your inner circles within your families. I talk throughout the campaign about the disparities that exist in health, wealth, miseducation, school to prison pipeline, foster care to prison pipeline. There are so many, there are just so many areas that, especially, you know, Black families who've lived in Charlottesville, natives of Charlottesville, have suffered under the leadership in Charlottesville. And I've been vocal about it. When I was in, you know, school, going, I would refuse to attend classes with teachers who were, who I felt were disrespectful and didn't honor me and thought I wasn't capable and thought other Black kids weren't capable. You know, if I was in a situation with police officers, I expressed to them how I felt. If they were arresting people or mistreating people, you know, individuals in front of their kids, I've been vocal, you know, about those, you know, things for years. And since 2004, working in the nonprofit sector, I've been vocal at every table I've ever sat at. You know, been told things like stay within my pay grade, who hired her, get her out of here, she's disgruntled. So just constantly in the rooms fighting to make sure that people, one, understand that if you sign up to be of service, do that. And, you know, just to bring attention to the fact that that they weren't. And I thought for all these years that I was wasting my time, right? And then I decided to, you know, because of Holly Edwards, to make the decision to run, to honor, you know, her legacy and continue her work. And now I have all these stories, tons of emails, letters, you know, I have all this proof of all the things I've seen over the years of where our leaders have failed us. Behind that, you know, pretense of perfection and that they were doing their best.
Again, our guest today, Nakia Walker. She, running for city council as an independent candidate, was also received a lot of social media attention for some of the activities in August 12th. That still sounds worded so inappropriately.
What? The
when I say you received a lot of attention for August 12th, still sounds so, like, how would you phrase that?
You know, I haven't really dealt with August 12th. So I've seen what has been, you know, posted and put up, and, you know, I move from it. It's, you know, it's very challenging. And the imagery that you see, the videos, any pictures, even the pictures, like the picture of the guy flying over the car and the shoes sitting on the ground. I mean, so we were there. We were right there for that. It's not, I don't need any of the attention that maybe people are giving that. And I'm not paying any attention, you know, to that attention.
That was Sunday morning wake-up call anchor Rick Moore talking with Nakia Walker about the events of August 12th in Charlottesville, as well as her run for city council. Ms. Walker won her bid for a seat on the council in November. You've been listening to the Sunday morning wake-up calls. Look back at 2017 on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. A reminder that this and every episode of The Wake Up Call is available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Coming up at noon on 94.7 WPVC, it's El Club del Sabor. For The Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. Thanks for listening.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.